Okay, welcome everybody. Welcome everybody to the fourth in this series of lectures on the topic of accommodating injustice. My name is Ray Langton, and it's been a pleasure giving these lectures to give you a sense of what I have in mind by the accommodation of injustice. I'll just remind some of you and tell others of you that I began with a quotation from Justice Brandeis, who said that to courageous, self-reliant men with confidence in the power of free and fearless reasoning applied through the processes of popular government, no danger flowing from speech can be deemed clear and present unless the incidence of the evil apprehended is so imminent that it may befall before there is opportunity for full discussion. And this is the crucial bit for today. If there be time to expose through discussion the falsehood and fallacies, to avert the evil by the processes of education, the remedy to be applied is more speech, not enforced silence. And I said at the beginning that this was a really wonderful ideal of speech, a really wonderful ideal, and that unfortunately, working with a really wonderful ideal of speech can actually get in the way of justice. It can actually make justice more remote because it makes us think we are already living that ideal, as Brandeis perhaps did, though I will get to that topic again in Lecture 6. So the picture of speech there, speech as free and fearless reasoning, is a picture that I have been trying to undo a little bit. Of course, I'm not denying that there is plenty of free and fearless reasoning, but I am interested in speech that is of a different sort. And I'm interested in how what we do with our words follows what some philosophers have called rules of accommodation. So accommodation, by my title, Accommodating Injustice, the first thing I mean is, you know, Brandeis didn't do a good enough job of accommodating injustice in the sense of making space for injustice in his political theorizing. If we act as if we are already at the destination, we're less likely to achieve it. But what I have in mind more specifically is the more technical idea of accommodation, where it has something in common with the idea of being accommodating, helping something along. Philosophers of language have talked about how certain things we do with our words follow rules of accommodation. That is to say, what we do with our words requires something to be the case for it to count as correct play, and provided certain conditions are in place, magically, lo and behold, they are provided. So you have something said, the something said requires something to be the case. There need to be certain background conditions in place. Austin called them felicity conditions. And once those are all in place, the magic happens, and what's needed for the process of accommodation, the help provided by hearers in some circumstances, by social conditions in other circumstances, or a mixture of both of them, once these conditions are in place, what's needed gets provided, and what one has is a felicitous speech act. So I'm working with an account of accommodation that puts together insights from J.L. Austin and from Lewis, drawing occasionally on Starnacker and other work, but it's not exactly the picture of accommodation that that linguists use who confine it to one particular case, namely presupposition accommodation. It's a much broader picture than that, and it's got lots in common with the picture that Lewis was working with, actually, in his paper, Scorekeeping in a Language Game. So, Austinian speech acts follow rules of accommodation. Someone names a ship. They say, I hereby name this ship the Queen Elizabeth. Provided certain conditions are in place, provided the speaker has authority, the ship is straightway, to use Lewis's word, straightway named the Queen Elizabeth. But suppose, and this gets onto our topic for today, suppose instead some low type, that was Austin's phrase, Austin's humorous phrase, some low type were to rush up to the ship and grab the champagne bottle and say, I hereby name this ship the Generalissimo Stalin. Anyway, it would be an infernal shame, of course, said Austin. and the ship would not be named the Queen Elizabeth. Now, I'm interested in how what sort of type you are affects the illocutionary force of your speech. But that particular, in the first case, what we had was a felicitous speech act, a naming of a ship, that was felicitous because certain conditions were in place, what Austin called the Felicity conditions, and when they were all in place, the magic happened and the ship was straightway named the Queen Elizabeth. I take that straightway, by the way, very seriously. At that time that the utterance is made, that is when the Illocutionary Speech Act is performed. And by the way, this happens even when some of the Felicity conditions are in the future. You might think that sounds like backwards causation. It's not backwards causation, but it is a Felicity condition that is sometimes in the future. Presupposition provides an example of this. Even George, I believe it was George Lakoff, this is an example from Lewis, I mentioned it before, even George could win. Even, that little word even, adds to the conversation the presupposition that George is an unpromising candidate. It adds that to the conversation, provided nobody blocks it and says, what do you mean, even George? So it's an illocutionary speech act of asserting that George could win, and also, by the way, of performing a sort of backdoor Austinian speech act of ranking George as inferior, a verdict that ranks George as inferior, provided certain Felicity conditions are in place, and in this case the Felicity condition that is an in the future and it's an absence. It's a failure to block. So, and then in the week one, I use this way of thinking about speech to show how ordinary hearers can contribute through their omissions to some surprising phenomena, and in particular, the authority of speech acts that might do bad things to people, speech acts that might subordinate, speech acts that might be hate speech. They can get authority if the speaker presupposes their own authority, and hey presto, if the Felicity conditions are in place, including future omissions of the hearers, this speech act can have the force of subordination. And I drew on some examples from Ishani Maitra to explain that. The other part of Austin, the other part of the naming of the ship example, the other aspect, the low type, illustrates how things can go wrong. Things can go wrong when the Felicity conditions are not in place, and when that happens, Austin said there was a misfire. So in general, there are different ways things can go wrong. There is another kind that I mentioned last week, but I won't discuss today, where a successful illocutionary act is performed, but it's a kind of abuse of the speech act. So a promise where you're not intending to fulfill the promise can still be a promise, but it's an abuse of the speech act if you're not intending to. I'm not going to talk about them today, though I did mention them briefly last week. So today I want to talk about misfires. Not just misfires, I want to talk about how a certain sort of silencing can be understood in these terms as the failure of someone's speech to be accommodated. The failure of someone's speech act to be accommodated because the conditions are not in place for the accommodation of their speech. Austin's work was full of wonderful examples of misfires. He had not just the low type who failed to name the ship. He had the couple who are trying to marry, but the priest turns out to be a monkey in disguise. He had the saint, the short-sighted saint, who baptized the penguins. From a novel by Anatole France, I think. Anyway, so he has, you know, Austin was absolutely wonderful, and one of the things that makes him so fun to read was his extremely wild imagination about how things can go wrong with our words. I'm not sure if he would be rolling in his grave with my application of his work, but I think that the phenomenon of misfire is one that has political significance, and I've already talked about one side of it, and I've called it illocutionary disablement. Illocutionary disablement occurs when there is a kind of systematic pattern of misfiring where someone uses the right words, just like the low type used the right words for naming the ship. Someone uses the right words, but the words fail to have, the speech act fails to have the illocutionary force that they mean it to have. Some examples that are very Austinian in flavor would be someone is trying to vote. They make marks on the paper, and they are the wrong sort of person to be voting because it's apartheid South Africa. That would be an example of a misfire where you're saying the right words and you're not doing what you're meaning to do in, with your words. Another example I drew from Davidson, and you have to be careful with it. Someone's role in a play is to say, "Fire, I mean it, look at the smoke." They have to say it more convincingly than that, but for obvious reasons I won't. Okay. And then a real fire breaks out, and they say even more convincingly, "Fire, I mean it, look at the smoke." And no matter what they try, even if they had a nice assertion sign, which is what Davidson was talking about, that wouldn't be good enough to help them warn. So what you have, even though Davidson didn't put it this way, is the example of someone saying the right words, but something about their circumstances is silencing them in the sense of depriving their speech act of its illocutionary force. Now, the example of the marriage and the voting already tells you that this can have political significance. Because just as the couple who might fail to marry because the priest turns out to be a monkey in disguise, so a couple can fail to marry because they're a same-sex couple and it's not possible for them to marry. That would be an example of misfire. An example that I have talked about, and so has Jennifer Hornsby, including in some joint work of ours, is a very, very important to anybody who is interested in how certain speech acts subordinate women. They might subordinate women by silencing women, by altering background conditions that prevent women's words from having the illocutionary force that they ought to have. Last week, I quoted from a documentary about Linda Marchiano, alias Linda Lovelace, where she was a bit like the actor in Davidson's story, who was interviewed and was performing a script that her pimp was telling her to perform, and then when she went on to say that this was the result of threat and that she was abused in the making of the film Deep Throat, nobody believed her, and there was something about, in fact, I mentioned this in a different paper, not only did nobody believe her, her protest was sold actually as pornography. I actually found an advertisement for it in my junk mail, and this little experience in my graduate career, as a graduate student, is what got me thinking about speech acts. That there, the advertisement for Linda Lovelace, star of Deep Throat, tells the. Anyway, I'm not going to go into the whole detail of the advertisement. It was an extraordinary thing because the protest was being sold as pornography. Anyway, I'm not going to talk more about that today, but it's an instance of how you can be saying the right words and they are not the speech act you're meaning them to be. And that is a sort of silence, which, by the way, I don't believe is metaphorical. Once you think that speech is a matter of performing speech acts that have illocutionary force, then silence is a matter of having your speech acts deprived of illocutionary force. It's not a matter of being, it can be a matter of being gagged, it can be a matter of being punished, but it's also a matter of saying your words and not being able to do the illocutionary thing you're meaning to do with your words. The example I want to talk about today is one that Jennifer Hornsby and I have talked about elsewhere, and it's the example of sexual refusal. Now, some of you will remember that the general pattern for accommodation, when accommodation is successful, is that something is said, it requires something to be the case, provided certain conditions are in play, the felicity condition part, then there is a felicitous outcome, and it has the illocutionary force in question. And we've looked at many examples of felicitous speech. I've looked at felicitous, in the technical sense of felicitous, felicitous hate speech that can be subordinating because it's authoritative, and it can be authoritative because authority itself follows rules of accommodation. That was the topic of lecture one. I talked about how social norms follow rules of accommodation, And this, there's an example of this, a rather stylized example, with an Austinian flavor in Lewis. The master says to the slave, "You are now permitted to cross the white line," and straightway the slave is permitted to cross the white line, provided certain conditions are in place. So something is said, it requires something to be the case, namely that the permissibility facts shift, provided certain conditions are in place, that the master is the master and has authority, then it is indeed an alteration of the permissibility facts. So I talked about how social norms, not just the explicitly formal ones where you have an authoritative speaker, I talked about how many different speech acts alter social norms, including ones that look just like assertions, and including ones that look just like assertions by non-authoritative speakers. And they can be altering social norms because they normalize certain things. That was a topic of an earlier lecture. I also talked the next week about how knowledge itself, or at the very least certain factors very closely connected to knowledge, follow rules of accommodation. This part of this is implicit in work on contextualism about knowledge, the idea that standards might shift in response to rules of accommodation, also stakes, also credibility, and then perhaps knowledge itself. The master knows that the permissibility facts have shifted. So I've been talking about felicitous, successful speech acts, and today I'm going to be talking about unsuccessful ones, because it's here we get the idea that certain speech acts can silence. Certain speech acts can be silenced. So, something is said. This is in a situation where a woman is wanting to refuse sex, and she says no. What that needs, what the requirement is that should count as a speech act of sexual refusal. That, in that case, is what she means it to be. Certain felicity conditions need to be in place for that to be successful. I'm not going to speculate what they all are, but some of them might be that the speaker intends to refuse. Maybe I'll just say and for all of these. The speaker has authority to refuse access to her body. The hearer recognizes that the speaker is intending to refuse. That's what Austin called the uptake component. By the way, that is another felicity condition that is in the future relative to the speech act in question. Now, many feminists have talked about how women can be silenced by pornography. And what Jennifer Hornsby and I suggested is that this silencing claim can be understood as a claim that speech acts of sexual refusal, also testimony, by the way, speech acts of sexual refusal can be silenced because no is not taken to be a sexual refusal. And I put that in terms of a failure of uptake. The hearer does not recognize what the illocutionary force is supposed to be, because the hearer is in the grip of certain rape myths, which are described by Ronald Dworkin as being shared by some judges. Anyway, this is a quotation from Ronald Dworkin. Pornography conditions some men to think, as some stupid judges have instructed juries in rape trials, that when a woman says no, she sometimes means yes. That's a bit where he's conceding that part of a feminist critique that he then goes on to reject. Sorry, he agrees with that bit, and he just says that sort of silencing doesn't matter. I think it does matter, but that's not part of today's argument. When that happens, you have someone trying to perform the speech act of sexual refusal, and something goes wrong. It doesn't count, I said, as a refusal. And some have said, well, it doesn't count as a fully successful refusal. I think that's Jen Hornsby's favoured way of putting it. I'm happy to say it doesn't count as a refusal. That's because something has gone wrong. What has gone wrong? a failure of reciprocity, is what Hornsby would say. I want to point out that there are all of these other felicity conditions too that might be relevant. Authority to perform speech acts that control what goes on with your own body. Uptake of the hearer, I already mentioned, that's what I focused on initially. Background convention, that no is the right word to use in that context. When I said authority, I meant practical authority, because that's the authority that you need in order to issue directives like no or get out or stop. Maybe also epistemic authority. Does she really know what she wants, or does he know better? There could be exercises of epistemic authority in place as well. Now, obviously, to make this idea at all credible, we would need a lot more data. We would need a lot more evidence that that rape myths are there, and that maybe and that pornography might contribute to them. I think the evidence is there, but I'm not going to take time today to talk about it, except to draw attention to something I've only just discovered, which is a report, a government report done by the Children's Commissioner, the Office of the Children's Commissioner, whose title is Sex Without Consent, I Suppose That Is Rape. So it's in the, and the subtitle is How Young People in England Understand Sexual Consent. I only discovered that this document last week, so I've put some quotations from it on the handout. In this study, many interviews were done with high school students to get some sense of their understanding about sexual consent. And they had quite a good understanding of what that rape meant, sex without consent. But they didn't have a very good understanding of what was needed for consent, and they didn't have any understanding at all about what might be needed on the part of other parties to get consent. Anyway, I've just given... one thing that they say is that there's a prevalence of rape myths, and a rape victim in the scenarios that they discussed, who is usually a girl, though sometimes the boys were, in some of them a boy was also a victim, is invariably blamed for their own assault. They should not have gone to visit the boy. They should not have worn a tight top. They should not have had the drink. They have done it before, so they have no right to say no. I think that's very interesting, that part, because it's about how once you've done it, there's a kind of universalizability. Well, you did it with him, so why not with me? That bears on the question of whether the speaker has authority, the practical authority that I mentioned. Now, in our first thoughts about this, we discussed the way that reciprocity can be undermined, that the mutual capacity for uptake can go wrong. I don't want to say that rape is about misunderstandings and miscommunications. I now think that I overestimated the extent to which that might be the case, because there are studies coming out that suggesting that there's far more strategic and nasty stuff going on, and rape, as I'm sure everyone knows, is a massively, massively underreported crime. So I think this is a very important issue. I'm wondering, too, whether there is a case of mixed messages where it's not the woman giving mixed messages. But anyway, I'm just going to throw this out there and see what you think about it. So I was struck by this because some of you might know that the No More Page 3 campaign, the campaign to eliminate the topless model on page 3 of the Sun, is it? Had lots of slogans like boobs aren't news, and another slogan was that I saw was talk to the brain because the boobs aren't listening. Anyway, and what struck me about this was, okay, maybe they think maybe it's not about the boobs listening, it's about them talking. So here, look at this. These are high school students talking. It was a bit her fault for wearing that top. It is a bit her fault. That's a young woman in year 11. So that's the victim blaming thing. So in this scenario, a 14-year-old girl is gang raped by three boys after visiting her boyfriend's flat. And she had worn a tight top. Okay, so maybe because she dressed like that, maybe she wants it in a way. Young man, year 11. By the way, notice the wants it. So really interesting, the way that people are talking about sex, as if wanting might be the same as choosing or deciding. There's a sort of conflation between sexual desire and decision. This is something that is very important if we're going to understand consent and refusal as performative speech acts of decision and communication of decision. I think she would be more responsible because she had that top on. Because it started off with that top saying... And then another boy said, it's like a door saying, fire exit. You're going to go through that if there's a fire. And another boy said, yes, big flashing sign saying, come to me. It's like a sign on your head saying, shag me. Great. So anyone interested in speech act theory can't help being very struck by how people are talking about the girls asking for it because something is asking for it. Something is asking for it. And so that's why her no isn't... That must have something to do with why her no is not counting as a refusal. Anyway, what I want to point out, and this is only part of what I want to talk about today, is that sometimes things go wrong with speech, where it is literally impossible to perform the speech act in question. The low type, it's impossible for the low type to name the ship because the felicity conditions are not fulfilled. Actor trying to warn, if it's convention ridden enough, it's impossible for the actor to warn. Illocutionary disablement is a very important thing to take notice of, and it is only visible when we understand speech in terms of speech acts that can go wrong through being made impossible in this special way. Sometimes political philosophers talk as if the worst thing that anyone could do to silence a speaker is to punish them, you know, fine them, threaten them, put them in jail or something. Actually, making a speech act literally impossible, when you think about it, is worse. You know, someone who is trying to perform the speech act and fails, it's not that they're disobediently performing it and getting punished, they can't do it in the first place. So the silence is even deeper in that way. Now, there are many, many speech acts in this vicinity. What I want to do, though, is say we should consider not only the silence of illocutionary disablement, which is basically Austin's misfires understood in a political context. We should also think about other handicaps on speech where the handicaps do not make speech acts impossible, they just make it difficult. And I've become increasingly interested in this issue of handicaps that don't make the speech act in question literally impossible. That was illocutionary disablement. These handicaps simply make speech more difficult, and that is really relevant if we're thinking in response to Brandeis, about whether bad speech can always be answered with good speech. If it is hard for bad speech to be fought with good speech, then we mustn't be so blasé about the conditions under which certain speech should be given a complete free pass. So I'm interested in these handicaps. So for the rest, so I've said what I was going to say now about illocutionary disablement. Now I'm going to move on to the wider topic of handicaps and where the problem is not the impossibility, but the difficulty of performing certain sorts of speech acts and how that difficulty can have a political dimension which we can understand better when we understand what's going on in the speech situation. You know, there was a caveat I meant to utter at the beginning of this, and I'm going to utter it in the middle instead. I just forgot. When we're thinking about silence, and when we're thinking about the injustice of the speech situation, actually, the issues I'm talking about here to do with accommodation failure and accommodation challenges and difficulties are probably only a tiny, tiny bit of the problem. So much, much bigger problems are going to be, you know, massive asymmetries of power and wealth. Newspapers that have gigantic megaphones because they have so much because they have so much money, and they have a completely different motivational structure. They're not exactly million seekers after the truth. Anyway, sheer illiteracy. There are going to be many reasons to do with absence of material resources and education that mean that many, many speakers are never going to be in a position to answer the bad speech that Brandeis thinks they ought to be able to answer with their good speech. Here's one other thing that I never even thought about properly, even though it's absolutely staring us in the face. Most of the relevant speakers are not even members of the conversation. So think about hate groups on the internet. The targets of the hate speech are not exactly, you know, bystanders who could say, hey, what do you mean? I'm a human being too. They're just not part of the conversation. So the absence from the conversation in the first place is a structural issue. And so all of these issues are probably way more important than anything that I have to say today. But nevertheless, I think what I have to say is a part of it that is especially philosophically interesting, and where philosophy can make a contribution in helping us understand its dynamics. So that's my excuse or defense or vindication for focusing on it, even though possibly other things are a bigger deal. I'll leave them to Chomsky and others. Anyway, I'm thinking of his work on propaganda. So I want to talk then about handicaps and difficulties. Why is this important? Because many things that are done with words that are damaging to people are done through what I've been describing as backdoor speech acts. Presupposition introduction, even George could win, is an example of a backdoor speech act. And I'm tempted to use the word presupposition in a broader way than philosophers of language would probably like me to, but please just bear with me, because I need a label for something which I don't know how otherwise to label. I'm not going to get into a dispute about whether it's really implicature, or whether it's pragmatic presupposition or semantic presupposition, or what sort of backdoor speech act it is. But it's these backdoor ones that are interesting. And why do we need to think about challenges? Because among the felicity conditions for the success of backdoor speech acts are the omissions of hearers, the failures of hearers to block. If hearers don't say, what do you mean, even George? Or, wait a minute, I didn't know George was so unpromising, such an unpromising candidate. If the hearer doesn't make that move, then the speech act gets the illocutionary force that it, in a way that is parasitic, not just on the pre-existing social conditions, but on the other ones. And when, as I said before, you can actually get authority that very way by presupposing your authority and it being accommodated by hearers, it becomes especially crucial to understand how certain sorts of blocking maneuver can face challenges. So one of the things I'm very interested in, and that's what I'll talk about first of all, is how backdoor speech acts are hard to block. They're not impossible to block, they're hard to block. They can be hard to block. Here are some of the challenges. Some of the challenges are epistemological. In a conversation, if someone says, even George could win, the focus of attention is on George could win. The focus of attention is not on even George could win. Although, of course, in a conversation among philosophers, especially philosophers who are talking about this, they become very alert to them. So there's a kind of under the radar quality to presupposition, which is not there in outright assertion. Now, I said last week when I was talking about knowledge that we should understand knowledge to be a norm, not only for assertion, but for a variety of speech acts, including all knowledge-oriented speech acts. By knowledge-oriented, I'm not going to try and define it. What I have in mind is the speech acts which are through which hearers acquire knowledge in the good case. So in the good case, someone says, even George could win. A hearer acquires the knowledge that George could win, if this is a good case of testimony, and they also acquire the knowledge that George is an unpromising candidate, even though that was just presupposed, not asserted. And the speaker ought to say George, even George could win, only if he knows that George could win and he knows that George is an unpromising candidate. This is important because a huge amount of our knowledge is transmitted through the back door, through presuppositions. Marina Spisa, who I've been corresponding with about this, said that she did an analysis of, I'm not going to be very precise about this, but I think she did an analysis of one page of a newspaper and what its presuppositions were, and its presuppositions went for pages and pages and pages, what you would need in order to understand what was actually asserted. So a huge amount of knowledge gets transmitted through the back door, through what's presupposed. That's what I talked about last week. And that can be so even in fiction. I reminded you that anti-Semitic propaganda was very often fictional. It's very important to pay attention to what gets through the back door in this way, and it's harder to pay attention to it because it is precisely a backdoor speech act. So there's something under the radar about it. Okay. I've got two more things to say about the epistemology of these backdoor speech acts, or these speech acts via presupposition, broadly construed. The next thing is that they normalize whatever the content is of what's being presupposed, and they give it an epistemic normalizing as well. They present it as already shared knowledge. Now, I know there's discussion among philosophers about whether it is already shared knowledge, but in many cases, it's presented as shared knowledge, and that's we discussed that under the heading of normalizing. When you presuppose something, you present it as something that can be taken for granted and as something that people already know. Thirdly, and this is still on the epistemological issues, I suspect, and I welcome suggestions about this, that a speaker holds him or herself less responsible for what he or she presupposes than for what he or she asserts. I'll just throw that out there. I think that seems true. So someone who says even George could win, I should be talking about much more horrible examples, I'm just sticking with the one I started with, which is so innocuous. Someone who says even George could win feels, you know, really responsible for George could win. Yeah, I'm going to stick by my guns. What do you mean George could win? Yeah, George could win, and I'll give you reasons. But they feel less responsible for the even part, maybe precisely because it is apparently to them, a piece of background knowledge that can be taken for granted. So they're not, you know, claiming special epistemic authority for the even bit of the content, just the George could win bit. So just in terms of the epistemology of presupposition, you've got this really quite potent combination. It's under the radar, you're not really noticing it. It's being normalized by being presented as shared knowledge, and the speaker is being irresponsible about it, because that's not the point of what they're doing. So this together makes it a very potent mechanism for the transmission of knowledge or ignorance or misinformation. Now, those were about epistemology. Now I want to talk about some structural issues. It's been often commented that you can't simply block You can't simply block a presupposition by saying, no, that's wrong. Simple negation is not enough. If someone says, even George could win, you say, no, the no means George couldn't win. It doesn't mean, no, George isn't an unpromising candidate. You have to do something more complicated. This is relevant to something I've just been reading about, very interesting studies of speech in courtroom settings, which I think is very highly relevant to the issues of silencing more broadly. This is a paper by Alexander Davies that's in the readings, where he looks especially at loaded yes-no questions. So loaded yes-no questions seem to present a choice where the only possible options are going to do damage to the witness, say. So an example, in a rape trial, did you or did you not fail to take advantage of any of the later opportunities to resist? So there's an ontological commitment to the later opportunities to resist. The lawyer can say, answer the question, did you or did you not? And if the person says, well, there weren't any, I've explained, the barrister is in a position to have things struck from the record. There's something structurally very tricky about the situation of courtroom speech, and I'm really, I only just discovered this literature of people looking at the way language is used in courtroom settings, and it's a very familiar point that we all know what loaded questions are like, but what I hadn't realized is how they can very much shape the jury's views in certain ways. Were you or were you not wearing a top that exposed your breasts? You know, things like this. So you can say, so there are things barrister can say that really shape the speech situation. These are to do with structural features of presupposition. Another thing that's very interesting that I'm only going to mention, other people have talked about this more. Lewis commented on the asymmetric pliability of accommodation in certain contexts. Famously, supposedly, the skeptic drives away knowledge. Why? Because standards for knowledge shift following rules of accommodation, so that they get heightened, they get raised in such a way that all of a sudden, paying attention to the skeptical hypothesis that maybe I'm a brain in the vat, oh, right, I guess I don't know that, and the knowledge goes away. Now, Lewis said, it's curious that you can't just shift the standard in the other direction very easily. And I mentioned already that I think he was idealizing or overgeneralizing for the situation of philosophers, who are, of course, complete nerds when it comes to precision. So, you know, it's very easy. So for us, asymmetry issue tends to mean that the one who's making it most precise is the one who gets to set the standard, which is a good thing in philosophy. But I also said that actually the asymmetry can go completely the other way in other contexts, and I mentioned the football example earlier. Okay, so Mary-Kate McGowan and others too have looked at the asymmetry of accommodation issue, Robert Simpson, and talked about how it might be implicated in certain sorts of oppressive speech. Now, I've been talking about epistemology, I've been talking about sort of structural issues about negation, which, by the way, tie into wider issues about whether you can just deny that a slur word applies. Anyway, sorry, I'm not doing justice to the topic of slurs. I now want to talk about how normative issues get in the way as well. There is no doubt that being a real pain of a hearer and questioning everyone's presuppositions, you know, that's being very uncooperative. And as Grice said, we have strong norms of cooperation, and among those, and I suggest that part of the norms of cooperation mean that other things being equal, you don't question the presuppositions of something, though, of course, the move of denying what someone's asserting is a straightforward thing to do. Blocking derails the conversation, and that can be a rude thing to do. Normative issues come in another way. When a speech act is an enactment of a norm, of course you can't block it. So, you know, no one, if there's a no smoking sign up somewhere, you can't say, oh, I'm not going to go along with that. I'm going to disagree. You can't undo it just with anything you say. You have to undo the authority structure that is behind the speaker's power to perform that speech act. So, the general point is that when a speech act is enacting a norm, in order to undo it, you can't simply question its presupposition. You need to undo the felicity conditions that made it an enactment of a norm, which is a much bigger task. And now don't forget that there are asymmetries of gender and other social groups, which are going to mean that there are asymmetries in risk-taking, in initiative, in politeness, in deference. One thing about accommodation, which I think is worth noting, is that in one way it's conservative and in another way it's quite radical. It's quite conservative in that it gives a certain sort of privilege to whatever can, to the pre-existing stuff that can be taken for granted and shoved into the background. But it's also radical in rewarding those who take the initiative, who take risks, because it's in this language game, there's a bonus for the first player. There is a bonus for the first movers because then the hearers then have to accommodate to that or else block. All of these need way more defense than I'm giving them. That's what I want to say about presupposition in general. There are epistemic, structural, and normative issues which make getting stuff in through the back door and blocking stuff that's coming through the back door much more difficult than it would seem. Not impossible, just much more difficult. I now want to remind you of a related topic that creates additional problems. When I was talking about how norms follow rules of accommodation, I talked not only about the normalizing effect of presupposition, I also talked about the normalizing that goes on with certain forms of words that are there when we use generics, unquantified statements, which some philosophers have thought, I'm not going to get into a discussion of their truth conditions, but I am interested in their ambiguity and in the readiness that we have as hearers and as speakers to utter generics, to be completely muddy about which sort of generic we're uttering, and to tend to convert our various bits of quantified knowledge into generics. So the data that I'm drawing on here mostly comes from Sarah Jane Leslie. I'm not committed to her view about the truth conditions of generics, but it is very curious that among descriptive generics, we're willing to accept as true statements like mosquitoes carry the West Nile virus, which we're willing to accept that as true even if hardly any mosquitoes do. That's what she calls a striking property generic, and she compares that to cases like Muslims are terrorists, where you have a striking property that is associated with a few members of the group, that seems to vindicate the practice of describing them in these unquantified terms. That's a striking property generic. There are statistical generics, which is what most people start off thinking all generics are. They think it's a kind of shorthand for most F's are G. And then there are ones that are much more sort of natural kindy, where you're supposedly glomming onto the natures of the creatures in question. Ducks lay eggs or whatever. It's not just, it's not about the statistical proportion of ducks that lay eggs, it's about ducks laying. It's something to do with their biological nature. And Leslie is very interested in how these are what she calls an original sin of cognition. That is to say, we are very willing to utter them, and we are very messy about which versions of these we are uttering. Those were the descriptive ones. Then there are ones like boys don't cry. Now, the thing about, so that's not even descriptive, well, the point is nobody knows really whether it's being uttered as a descriptive statement, statistical, characteristic, or whether it's describing a certain sort of ideal. In other words, it's a disguised social norm. It's really shorthand for boys shouldn't cry. What does this mean? This means in practice that generics tend to be resistant to counterexamples. This actually is relevant to whether you think they can be answered by free and fearless reasoning. So, you know, for any sort of generic, actually, you can produce a few counterexamples and people will hold on to them, because for every kind of generic, they're compatible with there being, with some of the items lacking the property in question. And then, of course, when they're disguised norms, you can confront the possibility that not a single item, not a single thing that has this property, not a single thing that is supposed to have this property, does in fact have it, because it's just a norm, because it's a disguised norm. So they're stubborn. That's 4.1. Generics are stubborn. They're resistant to counterexample. They are slippery. That's what I said already. You don't keep track of which one you have in play. They're slippery among the descriptive ones. They are descriptive. They are slippery among the descriptive versus normative ones. They are self-escalating. What I mean by that is, you start with one, it starts blurring and fudging and moving into one of the others. So you start with something striking, and you start with a striking property, and it sort of becomes a statistical one in your head, except it's a bit vague, and then it becomes a characteristic one, and then depending on what it is, it might become a normative. It might become a normative one. You know, they are, you're not the right sort of thing unless you have the property. So they are very interesting. And you might also think that one of the issues with generics is that they work actually via presupposition introduction, in which case, of course, I'm not going to repeat myself. How many things did I list under the problems for presupposition? They all will apply to generics as well. As well as these additional things. There are so many things to say about this. The transgressions can backfire. The data on generics, nice liberal parents whose children come home saying, boys don't cry, and the nice liberal parents say, oh yeah, boys cry, it's okay, boys cry. The data suggests that using this apparent blocking maneuver doesn't work. Why not? Because the message is boy, girl, somehow this is really important. So my parents are now making a big fuss, although I haven't quite got onto it. So the boys do this, girls do that. So I was wrong when I thought the boys don't cry, but so what is it about boys? So there's a kind of, the effort at, I'm not saying it's impossible to block, but the natural way of blocking it, according to the data, tends to reinforce the very thing that you're trying to block. Of course, what you should say is, everyone cries. Anyway, and that would probably be more successful. Okay. So the refutations are less cognitively accessible. It's really complicated to explain all of these things I've just been talking about. To 4-year-olds who are really adept at using generics. The generics are much more cognitively accessible than an understanding of how generics work. So that means that they get in there in a way where they can't be explained and understood and battled against. And then finally, you have the thing that I talked about last week when I was talking about knowledge, how when in certain situations, you have a generic, I don't know, girls don't succeed at the highest levels in science. This is what Larry Summers was supposedly said. Actually, he didn't say it quite like that, to be fair. But anyway, so somebody utters generics of this sort. Because of social looping effects, these are self-fulfilling, and when they're self-fulfilling, they then give more inductive support to the initial generic, and then they seem to vindicate the generic as a statistical generic. They are pernicious because they then create the very knowledge of the thing that you were trying to battle. Anyway, so that you can see how this then connects up to the issues of authority that I talked about earlier, the issues of social norms that I talked about earlier, and the issues of knowledge that I talked about just last week. Now, I'm not saying that these handicaps are, you know, the death knell to using free and fearless reasoning. You know, I'm all for free and fearless reasoning. I just wish it was freer and more fearless. What we do need, though, is to understand how difficult it can be to utter the sort of speech that is going to undo, that's going to, you know, withdraw support, that's going to be disaccommodating, if you like, that's going to be unhelpful to the bad speech that is subordinating social groups and silencing social groups. It's more difficult than you thought, and it's more difficult in ways that we as philosophers can draw attention to and help ourselves and each other and people outside the academy understand. So, Brandeis, I hope, is right about the scope for free and fearless reasoning. It's just much, much more challenging than he thought. I'll stop there. Thank you.